Well, good morning, everyone. Let's try that again. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Perfect. Now, I have a gift for you later, but you have to stay to get it, so please don't leave early. My name is Donovan Brown, and I am here to talk to you about cross-platform continuous delivery. But before I get started, I want to start with an apology. If you were in the Wednesday session and you filled out your evals, I read every single one of those. One of the evals, the person shared with me that they were disappointed that they didn't actually get to see DSC in action. So I pulled an all-nighter. I'm working on 1 hour of sleep, but I redid this entire demo purely in DSC. So if DSC is what you wanted to see, you're going to finally get to see it. So if you're in the room, I apologize. If not, I hope you find this video on Channel 9, because I am going to go as knee-deep into DSC today for you guys, as well as show you how to use this across onto a Linux machine as well. Okay? So please fill out your evals. I do read them. I read every single one of them so that I can make sure that I deliver for you the content that you actually want to see. So with the apology out of the way, I also want to say thank you very much for attending this session. It's very special to me because this is my first solo demo at TechEd. I've been privileged to be able to present with Claude several times, and I want to thank him for having the confidence in me to let me come up here and talk about your baby, which I like very, very much. So I'm going to commemorate this real quick with a picture, so everyone say cheese, right, because you guys are my first solo audience. Actually, maybe I should be in the picture, so I want to just do a selfie here of me at TechEd. Everyone say cheese. All right, perfect. Thank you so much for participating. So let's talk about a little bit about more about why we're here and who I am. I blog quite a bit on this topic, build, and other things around TFS. I am actually a salesman, but I have a development background. I sling code every single day, right? It's just what I do for fun. I attached myself to release management as soon as I joined Microsoft. I've been working closely with the team, pushing it really, really hard. If you were in the Wednesday session, you might remember I said something about air hockey. I happen to be the 12th best air hockey player on the planet. And I know, right? And I got invited to go to Russia, so I am leaving here, going directly to an airplane so that I can go to Moscow and play in a tournament there for them tomorrow. When I'm not playing air hockey, I race cars for fun, so I'm a bit of an adrenaline junkie. If you've ever seen me demo before, you know I like a risk. That's why this is all DSC today. I could not make this more risky than I did by staying up till 6 o'clock in the morning to do this, taking an hour nap, and then coming over here to try to present this for you. I'm going to go spend some time in Germany. I love it because I was born there. Might be why I like BMW so much. I live in Houston, Texas. And again, if you want to follow me, you can follow me on Twitter and donovanbrown.com. The resources that I wrote for this course or for this demo are going to be available there. So if you see something you like, you can go up there and find out exactly how I did it. One of the things that I want to dispel today is that TFS and release management are just for Microsoft and just for .NET. As a TSP, I fly all over the place talking to customers, and if they're a Java shop, they immediately want to close the door in my face and say, Donovan, we're not Microsoft, so we don't need TFS. We're not Microsoft, so we can't use release management. That could not be further from the truth. As far as we're concerned, all code is created equal, right? We can version it, we can track it, we can test it, we can build it, and thanks to Claude, we can now release it. Right? It does not matter what technology you're developing it on or what technology you're going to be deploying it to. Right? If it's code, we can help you do it better with Team Foundation Server and release management when it comes from deployment. And with things like Cordova and Xamarin, we can even help you get to other platforms when it comes to mobile as well. So please do not think that TFS means Microsoft and .NET only. I've gone to organizations where they're using Macs, Linux, Unix, and PCs, and before I left, every single person in there was connected to the Team Foundation Server. And I'm going to show you some of the ways that we're able to get that to happen. So when you think of Team Foundation Server, think of it as an entire ecosystem. And every aspect of writing software is going to be covered inside a Team Foundation Server. You can install it on-prem, or if you want to, you can actually have us host it for you in a SaaS application. So you can go right now to visualstudio.com, log in and actually create a TFS right there in the cloud and start using it immediately. Doesn't matter if you're using, like again, Java, doesn't matter if you're using .NET, Power Builder, VB6, doesn't matter. All code is created equal. So how do we actually get connected to it if it's all created equal? Well, if you're inside .NET, inside of Visual Studio, you just use a tool called Team Explorer. But for many, many years, we've had another tool called Team Explorer Everywhere. And just like the name says, it's Team Explorer for everywhere. Mac, Unix, Linux, does not matter. If it is an Eclipse-based IDE, you can use it to connect to Team Foundation Server and have a very similar experience as all the Visual Studio developers have. And I'm actually going to be inside of Eclipse today, so you'll get to see Team Explorer Everywhere running today. A lot of Java developers also use IntelliJ. IntelliJ, out of the box, comes with Team Foundation Server integration. Right? So you don't have to do anything except check a box during installation, and as soon as you do, you can now connect to your Team Foundation Server. And then finally, if you're using something like Power Builder, VB6, SQL Server, or really old versions of Visual Studio, we actually have a MISCI plugin that will give you your source control integration, just like you had when you were using VSS or SVC or whatever source control system you were using in the past. You won't have all the work items and some of the cool polish that we have in Team Explorer, but you will have access to your source control. If you are a command line junkie, no matter if you're on Windows or on Linux, we also have a command line interface you can utilize as well. So all your batch scripts and files can all be updated and use our tools and our commands to connect to your source control. You like Git? We support Git as well, right? GitHub, any Git repository you want to connect to, we can connect to it with Team Foundation Server. So don't think that, again, TFS is just for .NET and Microsoft things. And that goes true not only for the source control and the testing and the work items, but it also goes for release management as well. We can release to Linux in several different ways. Before 6 a.m., this demo was using our agent-based deployment to deploy to Linux. And then by 6 a.m., it was using our DSC version to deploy to Linux. We also demoed here at TechEd the ability to run DSC on Linux, right? And obviously, everyone, if you're dealing with Linux, is familiar with Chef. We integrate with Chef as well. I spent a lot of time with those guys the other day, great group of guys, and it was really opening my eyes to how Chef does deployment and how we can better integrate it with release management and the story that we have as well. When you talk about release management, we're trying to make sure that we capture the entire stack. We want to manage everything for you, right? And I think of it more of an orchestration platform as anything else, right? It's more than just moving bits. It's about collecting authentications and authorizations. It's about sending out notifications. It's about running your test. It's more than just moving bits. It's transforming web.configs. It's making sure that as I promote my zeros and ones from one environment to the next environment, everything is automated. To me, that's what DevOps means. Automate all things possible, right? If you can automate it, that's good, because you don't want human beings in there working on that stuff and accidentally making a mistake. If we can automate it, the better. And as you can see here, with release management, we handle the entire stack for you. So how does release management actually work? This will be a little bit of a review for some of the guys who were in our earlier talk. But if you notice, I changed the icons on the right, because there is no limit. I don't care if it's a Linux machine, a Windows machine, or a machine hosted out in Azure, we can reach it with release management. And even out in Azure, we can actually have Linux machines as well, right? So if you guys haven't activated your Azure benefits with your MSDN subscription, I highly recommend you do so. You can go up there right now, spin up a VM that has Ubuntu on it, and go to town in a Linux environment, right? Or CentOS, I think, is another distribution that we have as well. Or Oracle databases, or SQL Server databases. It's amazing. And we can get you there with release management. In the center of the world of release management is a server. And the server is the guy who's the traffic cop. He takes the request for a deployment, orchestrates everything, and makes sure the deployment happens. Now, deployments can be triggered by human beings, or they can be triggered by our builds. In the demo that I'm doing today, we're going to do true continuous delivery. All I'm going to do is check in code, and that's going to trigger a release. That's going to start moving our code over to that Linux machine for us. So what ends up happening is there's going to be some type of event or stimulus that starts this release. And then the release management server is going to figure out all the information that we need and then tell the deployer, be it our agent, a Chef client, or the LCM from DSC, to go off and move those bits to the appropriate machines for us. Along the way, transforming web.configs, sending out notifications, and making sure that we have a full pipeline when it comes to release. Now, what I'm about to demo for you is a lot of cool stuff. So when you start thinking about DSC, the first question that came to me is, well, where do I put my scripts? I know we want to have code, right? We want to have our configuration as code. That's the purpose. So where when I ship my code, I ship the configuration with it, and the servers magically turn into what I want them. But where do I put them? Do they belong in their own project? Do they belong in the project that I'm actually deploying it with? And what you're going to see here is what I came up with. We're still trying to figure out the best practices for this. Okay, so this obviously works because I got it to work, and I'll show you how I decided to store my configurations. I'm going to show you a build definition. The architecture of the application that we're going to be playing with today is it's a .NET application on one end. That's a web API that has a couple endpoints that I want to expose. And then on the other end, I have a Java Spring MVC application written in Eclipse and in Java that consumes that resource. So I truly have a cross-platform solution. Part of it lives on Windows, part of it lives on Linux, and I have to deploy and build them together. So what I did is I created a custom build definition that allows me to build both of them at the same time. Since the solution requires both of them, I don't want to build one and then hope that the other one built. Or if I'm on an old version of the other one and a new version of the new one, I want them to be developed together, I want them to build together, and I want them to deploy together. And this build definition allows me to build my .NET right alongside my Java code. And I'll give you a little tour of that build definition as well. Then we're going to look at desired state configuration. So I hope you're in here, or I hope you watch this video so that you guys can finally see how desired state configuration and RM come together to make this a much nicer world for all of us. I wrote a couple custom resources. The custom resources are available on donovanbrown.com, so you can go up there and grab them. And resources are the driving force behind what makes DSC work. Okay, and what's nice about it is it's extendable. You can write your own. I've gotten pretty good at it, and I'll share some of those learning curves and best practices and cool little tools I found, how you could unit test your PowerShell and stuff like that. So follow me again on Twitter because I tweet that stuff quite often. And then obviously our release pipeline. We're going to go over that in some detail as well. So let's switch over here to our demo. And do not be surprised by the user interface. You're thinking, yeah, he's trying to pull a fast one on me. That is a new project MVC right out of the box. And you're right, but it's all written in Java, and it's all written in Eclipse. All I did is I lifted the bootstrap and the CSS and the styles from a brand new MVC C# application, but trust me and I'll show you, this is all 100% Java. A couple things I want you to point out or make sure I bring to your attention. One being the fact that this is actually hitting an Ubuntu server. So over here, this server is running locally in a Hyper-V. You can actually install Linux inside of Hyper-V. I think I have a blog post on that. If not, I will definitely post it, because a couple buttons you have to make sure you click just right to make sure that it'll install happily. But it did. And another thing that I want to bring to your attention are some URL values that are actually going to get changed for me. So when I click on the About button here, what's going to end up happening is it's going to start showing me some information. The information is obviously the name that I want listed here. This is actually coming from the .NET web service, right? It knows what I want to say. The Java application knows how I want it presented. So there's a presentation. So is this going to be an H2 or a paragraph? But the actual words, the text, comes from the .NET. So if I want to change both the words and the display, both teams have to be involved. So let's imagine that we're a Scrum team, and we're at our sprint review. And as a sprint review, what we do is we show our code to our product owner, and then we solicit feedback from that person. So we show them that the application works. This is a pretty good first sprint. It's a full-blown application. It actually does load up. And as he looks at this, he says, you know what, Donovan? I want you to change where it says your application description page, and I want you to put a verbiage there that I want you to put there. And I want you to make it smaller because it doesn't need to be that big. That request actually involves both teams, and I'm going to show you how we can actually track that work inside Team Foundation Server, divvy it up, build it, deploy it, and track it throughout the entire system. So I want to show you one other thing here as well. So that's my QA machine. I also have a local dev machine. The dev machine is only different in its URL and also where it's actually pointing to. If you may have remembered, the other screen, the port was 6061. The port here is 5051. The reason that I point that out is as I move from one environment to the next, those URLs have to be updated for me, right? I need my release path to make sure that my dev machine is pointing at the right web service and that my QA machine is also pointing at the right web service. I don't want to touch this. I want to make sure it's automated, and I'm going to show you exactly how I was able to automate that, even though I'm going to a Linux machine. So now that I've collected that input from my product owner, how do I actually capture that? So what we have here is we have our backlog. A backlog is a laundry list of any and everything that you want your software to do. He said that he wanted us to change the text and to make sure that it was a different size, and I've captured that here in what we call a work item. This work item could not care less if it's Java, C#, Power Builder, Visual Fortran, does not matter. Remember, TFS could not care less what code or technology that we're using. But I'm able to capture what I want. I'm even able to come over here and create a storyboard. So this storyboard will then have a graphical representation so that my users know exactly what my vision was as well. So storyboards go a long way to make sure that what I get at the end matches what I see at the beginning. And it's much easier and cheaper for me to create a storyboard than it is for me to write code, show it to you, and be wrong, then have to go back in and fix that. So using the new features inside of PowerPoint, I was able to create a very quick storyboard that says, that's what I expect that about screen to look like, guys. Like, great. So the next thing I do is I have my testers attack this product backlog item. And they go off and they write an actual test case for me. This is an actionable test case. They can go into inside Microsoft Test Manager, actually run this test case, and then associate those results to every single build. So I can go back and track, have the test been run? Did they pass or succeed? How is the quality of this particular build? Again, it does not matter if it's Java or not. I can then automate, which I have, this particular test case, and I intend to run it as part of this demo against that Linux machine to verify that we deployed our code there, we transformed everything okay, and we can fire up a web browser, hit that Linux web server, and actually see the page doing what it's supposed to do, all as a part of our pipeline. And then finally, I have my developers get involved, and they go back in based on the description, based on the information in the test cases, they're able to decide what they have to do. Now, one thing I like a lot about 2013 in particular is the fact that one team project can actually have multiple teams inside of it. And clearly, we have a Java team and we have a .NET team. And we can divvy up which work goes to each team. What we see here is we wanted us to change the message. And as I described earlier, the message is actually stored inside the web service itself, the .NET portion. And if you look over here where it says area, I've actually been able to assign this to my web team, which is my actual .NET team. And I'm going to show you why this is important here in just a second. If I back out of this guy and I look at the other item here, I can see that I've assigned this to my Java team. So now, because I've been able to assign these items to the appropriate teams, the teams can start getting very specific views of just their information. What I mean by that is if I were to go back to our product backlog, as a web team member, I really don't care what everyone else on the team is doing. I want to know what my team is responsible for. What I can do is simply click here and say, show me this backlog just for the items that pertain to the web team. So as a web team member, I can focus on just what's important to us and not be inundated with all this other information that's just making it confusing for me to find what I'm supposed to be working on. Same is true for the Java team. So if I were to come back here and say, let me see what the Java team is working on, I can see that as well. But if I am the product owner, if I am a stakeholder, if I happen to be the scrum master of this project, I need a holistic view, and I can give you that as well. So there's no wrong way to slice and dice this information. Each team can have their own specific view should they need it. And then finally, in the background, what a lot of people don't even realize is happening is Team Foundation Server is building these amazing reports for you. You don't have to lift a finger. They're just being generated. Just use the tools, and we'll be able to tell you things like this. That your tests were passing, you have two different tests against this particular work item, and these are how many hours you have remaining and how much work is in progress. So on one line, I'm able to tell you immediately if you're done or not. You're done when there are no more hours and there all the tests are passing and there are no bugs outstanding, right? And again, I didn't have to do anything but start putting the data into Team Foundation Server, and it generated all these rich reports for me. So now let's start talking about some of the stuff that you guys really came to see, which is DSC and how we're going to make all this magic stuff work. So what I'm going to do real quick is I'm going to switch back over to the PowerPoint, and I'm going to explain what DSC looks like. This will be a repeat for some people, but it'll be new for others. Let's imagine a world without DSC, which is basically the world that all of us live in today, where we assume we have some idea of what's on the machine. So if I'm delivering a ASP.NET web application, my assumption is IIS is running on that server, and it has the appropriate version of the .NET framework already installed. Based on that assumption, I then go and start copying bits over there, keep making sure that my web.config is correct. And then I hope that everything works when I fire it back up. But if any of my assumptions are wrong, chances of it firing up correctly are zero, right? It was an IIS installed. Or it had the wrong version of the .NET framework, and here we go with the yellow screen of death, which we've all seen, right? Because of something careless, because I'm not in control of that particular environment. But with desired state configuration, I can actually describe what that server should look like. I don't have to make it that way. I can say, before you install my application, I insist that you have IIS installed. I insist that you have .NET 4.5 installed. How you do it, that's up to you. But these are the facts that must be true for you to run my application. And all I have to do is say, that's what I want. So I just describe what I want the server to look like. And then in the background, this magic happens. These three keywords, which I'll go into more detail here when we start looking at code, because we are actually going to be looking at code in this demo, the get, test, and set are basically the different faces of a resource. A resource is the driving force that makes these things happen. If I need to copy files, I use a file resource. If I need to configure IIS, I use a web resource. If I need to enable a feature on Windows, I use the Windows feature resource. If I need to tokenize a web.config, I use the tokenize resource. You get the idea. But whatever it is that I need to do, I create a resource. And the resource implements this interface. Think of it just as an interface. A get method, a set method, and a test method. The get method does exactly what it sounds like. It will get you the current configuration of whatever that resource is. That's all it does. Matter of fact, it doesn't do much because right now, from everything I understand, DSC doesn't even use the get method, so most people don't even implement it, right? But you'll see I implemented mine. The test method will say, given these desired state, go test that configuration, see if it matches or not. If that returns true, that triggers the set. I mean, if it returns false, excuse me. If it returns false, it'll trigger the set, and the set will go make it true, whatever that takes, whatever that entails. These are basically just PowerShell scripts, and I'll show you one of them here in just a moment. So then we can share these through a gallery. I'm currently sharing mine through donovanbrown.com. Guys like Colin are sharing his through GitHub, and we are having plans to make sure that we have a gallery where you can go and get this type of input that's coming from the community as well. So desired state configuration allows me to describe what I want the server to look like, and then from there be able to make sure I can store that inside Team Foundation Server or the source control system of your choice. So now my configuration is code. When I check in my website, I'm also checking in the configuration that must exist for you to execute or to use my website. Okay? So that's desired state configuration. So let's switch back real quick and let's look at what this actually looks like. So if we get out of this guy and go over here into Visual Studio, I will show you a configuration. DSC is an extension on top of PowerShell, right? It's a domain-specific language that allows us to define configurations. So they introduced a new keyword called configuration, and then that word after it is literally just any name that I come up with. It's a function name. You'll notice if you look all the way at the bottom, I'm calling that function at the bottom. And what that function does is it creates something called a MOF file. A MOF file is a standard file that we can then give to the LCM, which stands for the Local Configuration Manager. And the Local Configuration Manager is the guy doing all the heavy lifting on the node that you're trying to configure. So writing this is much easier than writing a MOF file by hand. And you could. A MOF file is just text. But instead of you having to know all the intricacies of writing one of them, we came up with this ability for you to write them in much easier syntax, use these different resources, and then have us generate them all for you. We'll hand that to the LCM, and the LCM will make sure that this is true. And what I'm asking for here is for you to simply copy files and then go back in and transform a properties file. You'll notice down at the bottom it says search parameter pattern is config.properties. Imagine that said web.config if you're a .NET developer, right? Web.config has your connection strings, password, usernames in it, all which need to be transformed. Well, when I went over to the Java world and wanted to do the same thing, I found out that they call them config.properties files. And they look just like INI files. But I can then read those inside of my Java application just like I would read a web.config. And that's where those two URLs are that actually point to the right web services for the right areas. And that has to be modified. And I'm using this particular resource that I've written to actually go back in and tokenize those for me and be able to transform them. So they're very, very simple. It's a configuration, it's the node, and a node is just a computer, and now it even is a switch or a firewall. It's anything that I want to be able to configure that has an LCM running on it. So that's why they call it a node and not a computer, because earlier this week we actually configured a firewall using DSC. Once I know the node, I can then start using resources. File is a resource, Tracheon X tokenize is also a resource. And those resources then take parameters that actually tell us what the desired state of that particular resource is. All right? Any questions over DSC from the high level? There are other courses and demonstrations on DSC here at TechEd. I highly recommend that you go and actually watch those videos on Channel 9. I learned this by reading the PowerShell book. It's available on the powershell.org. It's a little 40-page PDF that you can download. That's how I got started. And then obviously a lot of Bing. right? Searching like crazy, trying to figure out why it didn't work quite the way I expected it to. And we have several of these. So this one right here is actually for my web application. That's the Java portion. I also have over here the ability to do my ASP.NET. Now, this one's actually a little bit more complicated. You remember I said I can say I must have IIS installed. I must have .NET Framework 4.5 installed. That's what I'm saying with those first two resources. Right? I'm saying that, hey, make sure that web server, which is the code name for the IIS server, is installed on this machine. Make sure that the .NET 4.5 framework exists on the server that you're intending to run my application on. Then copy the bits for me, and then even create the website inside of IIS. If all this stuff is already true, this will simply do nothing. But if any one of these resources returns false, it will then jump into action and make sure that that is now true. Copying files if needed, setting up IIS if needed, and even creating my website if needed. In my case, everything here is true except the files. I'm going to want to copy new files. The other three are basically no ops at this point. We have a question? Would you want to bring a microphone over for you?
Hi. When you're running this, are you able to run it in a kind of an audit mode? So rather than it just find that it's not set and then go immediately do that for you, is it able to tell you what it would have done as it found it wasn't set?
Great question, yes. Most of the resources in Start DSC handles the what if. If you're familiar with PowerShell, there's a what if flag. And what if basically says, if I were to have actually done this, this is what I would have done, but I really didn't do it yet. So just do a hyphen what if on all your PowerShell. A lot of them are actually starting, commandlets are starting to implement that. So you can see what would have happened had I done that. And make sure you also hit the slash verbose. I highly encourage that because it blurts out a lot more information on what the resource is actually doing. When we look at the way I wrote a resource, you'll see where that comes up as well. So where do I store these resources, are these scripts that I want to actually execute? Here in Solution Explorer for my people service, you see I added a configurations folder directly to my project. And inside there, I simply put my DSC scripts. There's a couple things you want to make sure that you do, though. And this kind of tripped me up at first. By default, when you add these files, if you were to click on one of them, this copy always down here is not copy always, which means it will not end up in your drop location, which means it will not be accessible via release management or any other tool that's trying to access it. So if you're going to create a configurations folder in your project to hold all your DSC scripts, make sure you go down to the properties and you set this to copy always. You can also say copy if newer, but definitely don't have it say not copy, because it will not end up in your drop location, okay? And once it ends up in your drop location, RM can get its hands on it, and then RM can start executing these scripts for you and getting your machines in their desired state, okay? Same thing when I was working in the Java world, which I'll go over to you here in just a second if there's nothing else I want to show you here. One other thing I want to show you here is the build template. If you come from the Java world, you're probably familiar with tools like Ant and Maven, right? Those are build tools that they have in that world. Well, you don't have to unlearn those. What we do in Team Foundation Server, when we have a Java project that we're trying to build that already has a POM file or already has an ANT script, is we simply just sit right on top of it, right? Since we are now controlling your source control, but you already have a build script that works, don't reinvent the wheel. Just tell us that, and we'll sit right on top of your POM file, and we'll execute the POM file for you, and then bring in all the results as part of our build. It's as if you had created the build directly. Underneath, what we're actually doing is we're using MSBuild to go off and start that POM file or start that ANT script for you. And what I've done is I basically just hijacked that build script. This build script is on donovanbrown.com if you need to leverage it. So what I've done here is I've said, not only do I want to build that POM file, but while you're at it, go ahead and build my .NET application as well. And when you're done dropping them, package that folder structure so I know which part's .NET and which part of it is just for my Java stuff. So it's really easy for me to pick up just the parts I need for each of the environments that I'm trying to target. While you're at it, go ahead and swap all these little transform and token files for me so that my tokenizer can actually switch out the values. When we get into the Java world, I'll show you what a token file looks like. It's the same concept that I showed you guys on Wednesday if you were in that session as well. So all I'm doing is telling MSBuild, I need you to go build my Maven file or my POM file, and I need you to go build my .NET and drop them in a place where release management can pick them up. I promised you I'd show that, so I wanted to make sure that you saw at least what we're doing from the build perspective. I think we're pretty much done here with inside of this guy here. So what I'm going to do before I start talking about a resource is I'm going to start the dominoes falling. What I mean by the dominoes falling is in my head when I think about DevOps, in my head, I always see this series of dominoes, right? that if I hit the first one, the next one falls, and it keeps on falling, and it all, if it works great, all the dominoes fall. Well, that last domino in my head has the word production on the side of it. And my goal is to start the first domino that's going to have this entire effect to where my production environment is going to be deployed to. That first domino is checking in the code, right? We check it in, that triggers a build. The build then triggers a release, that then takes it from stage to stage to stage until that last production domino falls. So let's go ahead, while I'm going to talk about something else in the background, let's start those dominoes falling. This is Eclipse. It does not have to be Eclipse to use Team Explorer Everywhere. It just needs to be an Eclipse derivative. For example, Code Warrior is an Eclipse derivative that people use to write some low-level stuff for EPROMs and all that kind of stuff. And it's based off of Eclipse, and I've installed Team Explorer Everywhere in there, and they were able to put in all their machine code into Team Foundation Server just like everyone else. So what I'm going to do is show you the Team Explorer Everywhere view, which is this on the right-hand side. Team Foundation Server is so much more than source control. It's work item tracking, it's reports, it's documents, it's build, it's so much more. And what we do with Team Explorer Everywhere is give you access to all that rich information directly at your fingertips. And the thing that I'm most interested in now is checking in my pending changes. So this is where my source control comes together with my work items. Remember, I created that work item. It says change the text and the size. It's at the bottom. That's the item that I'm working on right now. And these are the lines of code and the files that I've had to audit or modify to make this a true statement. And when I check it in, not only am I going to check in the code and trigger a build, but I'm going to associate those changes to that work item so that anytime in the future, I can go back to that work item and see every line of code that was modified to make it true. If you had a bug logged in the system and you went and changed code to fix the bug, we would be able to tell you at any point in time, these are the lines of code you changed to fix that specific bug just by linking them together like this. So let's go ahead and start that domino falling. So I'm going to go ahead and check this in. What this should do in the background is actually trigger a build. And this build that it's going to trigger is actually going to go off and start us through our pipeline, get us into release management, and we'll start seeing if this stuff is going to work or not. Well, while we're talking about that, let's go look at a resource. Remember, I promised you I was going to show you a resource? And I said a resource basically implements an interface, a get, a set, and a test. And that's what I've written here for one called tokenize. I believe I'm showing you the tokenize resource. Tokenization is my favorite feature of release management. Taking my web.config and keeping it fresh. Taking my properties files and making the modifications necessary. DSC is outside the realm of RM. It exists on its own and out of the box did not have this resource. So I had to go write it myself because I couldn't live without it. And this is what it looks like. So it's just a PowerShell script with different functions inside of it. And what we're going to do here is we're just going to go ahead and look at one of these. So this is the get, and actually, I lied on this one. I have implemented get before, but I didn't implement it on this one. Basically, that's a no-op, right? It doesn't do anything because it doesn't return anything at the point. But all it would do is say, given your desired state, this is what the state is currently today. The other one is the test, and the test is a little bit more complicated. I made my life a little bit easier because what I did is I actually went off and I wrote my own commandlets as well. I'm getting way deep into PowerShell right now, but commandlets are instructions that you can perform inside of PowerShell. You can write your own, and what I did is I wrote my own in C# because I'm a .NET developer, I'm a C# guy. PowerShell is a different language. Wasn't in the mood to learn it, so I went into C#, I wrote my commandlets there, and then I utilized my commandlets here, reducing the amount of code I had to write in PowerShell because I'm simply not comfortable there yet. If you're really good with PowerShell, you could have literally written every single line of your resource in PowerShell. And I've gotten better with it, and my newer resources are almost all written entirely in PowerShell. But when I wrote this and the stuff I wanted to do with file manipulations, I was much more comfortable inside of C#. So basically what I'm doing here is I'm simply calling write token is a commandlet that I wrote and I present to PowerShell so that I could use it inside of this particular resource. Okay, so if you go to your command prompt right now inside of PowerShell, you will not find a write token, right, unless you downloaded it already from me. And then the test is where I have to return true or false based on the current state of the system. I pass in what I want it to look like, and test will return true or false if it already looks like that or not. If it returns false, the set gets triggered, and the set will then go try to make it so. Pretty simple stuff, right? So it is just a PowerShell module that allows me to export whatever functions from there that I want. That is a resource, okay? And we have waves of them coming out. Literally, they're called waves from Microsoft. I think we're on wave 8 already, right? So it has over 100 resources in it. being written and tested and produced by Microsoft so that we can make the DSC adoption a little bit easier for people. For the gaps or the edge conditions that they miss, guys like me and Colin, we go out and we write our own, and we publish those as well so that people can start utilizing them. So any questions over resources? Basically, you're implementing an interface. Once the interface is implemented, you can start using it inside of your pipelines inside of DSC. Okay. So hopefully what's happening in the background here is we have a build that's going to go off and then trigger the star of the show, which is release management. Before we go there, though, I want to talk one more time about the tokenization that I needed. If we open our home controller inside of this Java application, here at the top, you'll see that I'm referring to about URL and contact URL. Those are the URLs that point to the web service in .NET that actually provides the text on the contact page and the text on the about page. Those are the values that have to be updated as I move from one environment to the next. And if you look at the properties file today, on my development machine itself, which I believe is down here, it points at an even different port than I told you before. 4041 is my development machine where when I hit F5, that's the place I want it to go. But when I take that and I move it to my development machine, it needs to point at 5051. And then when I take it off of my development machine and move it to my QA machine, as I showed you earlier, it has to be pointing at 6061. So how do I take this 4041 and morph it into 5051 in one environment and then 6061 in the other environment automatically? The way that I do that is I introduce something called a token file. This is the exact same concept that we had when we were using the agent-based deployer. And that's why I chose to do it this way. The agent-based deployment and release management came first. People are familiar with it. They probably already have token files just like this one. And I wanted them to be able to use those token files without having to modify them. So I put support that exact same metaphor using the tokenized resource that I produced. So alongside of my properties file, I created this properties file, .token. And what I did is I tokenized the about URL and the contact URL so that release management can identify these and then change them as needed as we promote from one environment to the next. Okay, so now that we understand what that looks like, let's go see if our actual build is progressing the way I want it to. Great. So what we have here is our build has completed, and then it then communicated with release management saying, hey, release management, I have these bits that I need you to start moving through our pipeline. And let me show you what that pipeline looks like. A pipeline is basically what we call a path. And a path defines the different variables or the different environments we actually want to promote through. So let me go ahead and zoom in here a little bit. So I have a dev environment and I have a QA environment. And I also have these different steps or phases that I go through each one of these stages. I go through the acceptance phase, the deployment phase, and the validation phase. At each phase, people can be notified that that phase has been completed or wants to get initiated. For example, the acceptance stage is a really unique stage to where when that gets triggered and you get the notification, nothing has happened to your machine yet. We're literally asking for permission to go and deploy onto that machine. And if you give it to us, we will then wake up and go ahead and deploy the bits onto that machine. You can also defer that. You can say, yes, I want you to deploy the bits, but I don't want you to do it right now because I'm using that machine. But a week from today, that'll be a perfect time for you to come back and deploy it. You can tell us a week from today, come back and deploy the bits on that particular machine. The people in the deployment phase are actually going to be notified that the deployment has happened, and then we want someone in the validation stage to go back and invalidate that the bits landed the way that we wanted them to. That could be running manual tests. It could be just looking at registry settings, files on the hard drive, whatever it takes for you to be able to validate, yes, everything deployed the way that we wanted it to. And if we choose to automate those steps, the system will automatically go past that step for us. But if we uncheck it like I've done at the bottom, someone has to manually go in and say, I say it's okay for you to continue throughout the pipeline. And as you can see here, I'm going to have two of them in a row. To leave dev, Brian Keller has to say it's okay to leave dev. To enter QA, Brian Keller also has to say it's okay for you to enter this particular environment. And I'll show you both of those notifications here. So what we're going to do real quick to just to keep this thing moving along is quickly show you what a release template looks like. So how do we use those desired state configurations that I just showed you that we were storing in our projects? We drag and drop tools or actions from our toolbox directly onto our surface, very similar to the way that we did it with the agent base. Where it gets different is the fact that we actually are running PowerShell scripts or GSC scripts. So under actions, you'll see there's two actions under here. One of them is running Chef, right? So if you already have a Chef infrastructure, you don't have to throw that away. You can utilize all that valuable IP that you already have with Chef and leverage that. Or you can say, I just want to run PowerShell or DSC. Remember I said DSC is a superset or an extension on PowerShell, but you can run just plain vanilla PowerShell scripts as well, right? So if you have a huge investment in PowerShell already, again, you can leverage that immediately in this world and intermingle it with resources from DSC, which I've done on my QA stage because running test really doesn't fit the get, set, test metaphor, does it, right? If I want you to run tests, I just want you to run them. Right? Every time I tell you to run the test, run the test. There is no testing to see if you've run them or not. Just run them again and keep running them. So that is just a PowerShell script that knows how to initiate the automated testing for me. But everything else in my pipeline is actually a desired state configuration. I'll show you that here in just a moment. So here I'm able to be able to define the files that I want and the parameters that I want. For example, remember the about URL and the contact URL, those values that need to be changed as I move from one environment to the next? Release management allows me to define those variables on every component, and I've defined two of them here, actually three of them, one for the about URL, one for the contact URL, and one for the destination path that I want you to copy those files to that define that particular service. So as you can see here, there's my 5051, and if I were to jump over to my QA environment, I can show you that over here they're going to be actually set to, excuse me, the 616061. And the reason I'm having to use an IP address is, again, I'm not a Linux guy, so I don't know how to make my Windows machine name resolve inside of my Linux world yet. I'm still working on that. So I had to put the IP address in there instead, but it's still the same concept. Question? At this point, I'm not using Chef. Good question. So the question is, why am I not using the Chef way of doing this to get to the Linux world? The reason why is because I'm actually using the DSC file resource to simply copy to a file share on my server. Fantastic question. And those are the kind of things that I learned for the 2 or 3 hours those guys spent with me on, I think it was Wednesday. I sat down with them, and they were really teaching me the Chef way of doing things so that I can make sure that when we integrate with Chef, we're using all the Chef resources. For example, environments in Chef are a perfect way to store those values, right? Those values should not be stored here. They should be stored on the environment inside of Chef, right? And we'll be able to leverage those from RM as well. Absolutely, absolutely. Because these values aren't, which is your concern. Now, to that point, there's no reason inside of DSC we couldn't do the same thing. I'm going to show you why that's possible. It's a great question. So here, what we'll notice is that I have something called my PS script path. And then underneath my PS script path, I have a configuration path. The configuration path is just another PowerShell script that defines a hash table of values that I can now store inside of source control. So instead of actually putting those values here inside of my pipeline, I could have stored them in a configuration file that's in source control. So should they change, I would be able to go back in and verify those. And what release management will do is it will load both of those PowerShell scripts, one that has my actual values in it, and then run my DSC against it, giving you exactly what you want. Great question. Okay, I wish I had something specifically to give to you because that was like a really good question on that one. But we have both of those abilities. The reason that I personally like this, and I understand there's a transition there, I come from the RM world. Right, I come from the agent-based deployment world, and this allows me to very easily in one place be able to control all my values and see them and compare them side by side. But you do lose the ability to go back and audit that and see, well, have those values changed? What were they a year ago than they were today? Because if I change them now, you didn't know if they were changed from something else or not. So it's whatever you're most comfortable with, we allow you to do both. Good question. So what ends up happening is these DSC scripts end up in my drop location. I then pick them up, and then I execute them just like I would execute anything else. Now, this is what it looks like on my QA stage. You'll notice down here at the bottom, I actually am saying I want to run my test. And running test takes a lot of different variables. What's really nice is some of the values don't change very often, but the script actually needs them. So what I was able to do is when I define my component for my test, I was able to not only define variables, but define default values for those variables, right? So instead of me having to fill in 20 variables every single time, when as you can see, 4 of those are going to change very rarely, I don't have to indicate those on each individual action. I'm able to go ahead and take this default value, but I have the power to go ahead and override it if I should I need to on that particular item. So it's very convenient to be able to set the variables globally and then go back in and override them in each individual action as well, okay? So let's see if my deployment is actually working the way that I want it to. So at this point now, we are basically in a validate deployment step. So that's the current step here. And if I open this guy up, I'll be able to come in and look at the log. And the log here will show me everything that's happened and show me that it's run two desired state configurations against here. One for my web service, and if I look at the log, this is what desired state looks like. So if you did a what if, you would basically get this output, but nothing would have happened to your system. And if you do the what if with a slash verbose, you'll see all this cool logging information. Did I find the files I was looking for? Did I transform anything, or would I have transformed anything? And as you can see, it goes through and it says, I'm going to go ahead and test, and then I'm going to decide if I need to set it or not. And when it says skip set, that means the test returned true. There's nothing for me to do. If it weren't true, then you would actually see the set execute, and then you get all the dumping of the information that the set had to do to bring your system into the desired state. So this is just a big, long file here of everything that it had to do. And here's the Tracheon website going off and testing to see if things are true. And as you can see, I skipped the test, skipped the set, because the test came back and said that website on that port with that physical hard drive already exists. Right, so there's nothing for me to do. I was able to verify that it is in the desired state, so I skipped it. Had it not been, it would have created the website for me. So now what we're going to do is we're going to try to get it to go past the second pipeline here. So the first thing I have to do is I need to do an approval. One thing I like about the new stuff that we've done as well is that work item that I selected, remember I showed you the code that I was changing and the work item I was working on? Release management understands that as well. So if I want to see what items the developers believe that they've done in this particular release, I can see that chain summary here inside of the IDE. I'm going to show you one other place where we can see this information as well. But when people ask me, well, why would I use release management over Octopus? Or why would I use release management over one of our other competitors? This is the kind of things that I always point to. The integration between release management and Team Foundation Server is clearly second to none. Right? We're obviously going to integrate better with ourselves than anyone else. So we have this type of traceability that you simply can't get from other products on the market. Right, so this is why I would always give the lean or the edge to release management if you're using Team Foundation Server in your backend, because it just works so well all together. So now I have an approval request. This is where it's saying that Brian Keller has to say it's okay to leave the dev environment and try to enter into the QA environment. But before we do, I need to verify that it actually did that. So if I fire this back up and I go to my dev website, what I should see here is that the name has changed. Remember, this was a big, bold text? And it said, please put in your random description here. And we've changed it per the work item to say Fabricom. And we've also reduced the size from an H2 to a paragraph, which means both the .NET guys have updated the text appropriately and the Java guys have updated the appearance or the user interface appropriately as well. And we were able to deploy that. The next thing we want to do is get it over here to the QA machine. And we're going to do something a little bit more special when we do that. So I'm going to go ahead and approve this. So let's say it looks good. And now what we're going to do is we're going to try to get this onto our QA machine. But before we can, you can see it's already prompted me saying, hey, before we go to QA, someone has to approve that it's okay. So this is another thing that we give you, right? So it's not about moving the bits. It's about orchestrating the movement of the bits, the approvals that have to happen, the notifications that get triggered. And this is one of those such notifications. I did the first one here inside of the IDE. I want to show you that there is also another way that you can do that, which is here within the web page. And just like I was able to show you before, here I can actually see the chain summary of what was actually modified. So I get full traceability directly from the website as well. I don't have to install the RM client to get all the rich value that comes from RM. All your stakeholders or anyone who is an approver can go to this website for free. There's no licensing whatsoever to be an approver and be able to look at all this information and move their code throughout the pipeline for you. So I can see what changes were made. From the website, I can also determine how it got to the current stage that it's in. We're currently in QA. The previous stage was dev, and as you can see, I said it looked good. And you have full traceability on what moved, when it moved, and who said it was okay to move it. So we can go back in and point the finger at the person who might have broken something. And then here, after I select it, I have the option to reassign it. Should I not have the amount of time necessary to properly validate that something has happened, I can reassign it to another team member. They'll be sent the notification. They can go back in and perform the approval for me and then move it throughout its pipeline. I could also go ahead and reject it. Had it not worked the way that I wanted it to, had the page not been updated correctly, I could reject it and it would stop the pipeline right now. It would not send any emails to QA or anyone down the pipeline because I rejected it at that particular stage. Right? It stops it in its tracks. But what I want to do here instead is I want to approve it. Now remember I said this acceptance step was kind of special because it allows you to defer things should you want to. And that's why you see this date at the bottom. It's asking me, do you want it now or would you like me to schedule this for sometime in the future? And what will happen is I'll wake up at that exact time and date and I will perform the deployment for you should you need to. I always tell the story of a QA lead who's 1 week into a 2 week testing cycle. I can't take new bits right now because it would invalidate my first week's test results. I'd have to completely start over again. And we need to get this release out. But I'm getting these emails saying, Donovan, there's a new build for you. Well, what I can do here is say, great, but I don't need you to deploy it now. I need you to deploy it a week from now after I'm done with all of my testing. And release management will orchestrate all of that for you. Set the date and time, it'll go to sleep, and on that date and time, wake back up and deploy the bits for you. Okay? And then we'll start the whole workflow again for you, send out the notifications, and make sure it goes to where it wants to go. So, like I always say, here goes nothing. Let's make sure that we start moving this guy through the pipeline. So I'm going to try to talk to you. This is a great time to ask questions. The reason why is because this is actually going to take over my machine. And if fingers crossed all things go well, Internet Explorer is going to fire up on this machine. And it's actually going to go test that Linux website and make sure that everything there is the way it's supposed to be. It takes a little bit of time, so this is a great time. Hands are popping up like crazy. We have someone coming to usher microphones.
Hi, yeah. So you were the example you just talked about then was about your QA lead. He's in a two-week QA phase, working on something already. How does this? How would you structure your source code in branches and?
Perfect question. So what I would do in a situation like that is I would have at a minimum a dev and a main branch at a minimum, right? When I run a team, what I tell them is that when my developers believe that a piece of code is ready to be tested, they will merge that into the main branch. That's our handoff to QA. That's where the builds are going to be triggered that potentially would make their way into production, never from the dev branch, right? Dev branch is a moving target. It could work now and an hour later be completely destroyed. But what we do is you say, I believe this is done, and we merge that into the main branch. That merge will actually be a check-in inside a Team Foundation server that could trigger a build that could then trigger the release force automatically. We had another question over here on the right.
If your QA guy is a week in then, is there a way of revalidating the environment just to make sure that you know no one's been into the environment while the guy's in the middle of his testing? So we've gone through the scripting to build the environment, deploy the code. The guy's halfway through testing it, and all of a sudden he starts reporting loads of bugs and stuff. And it turns out that one of the devs has been into the QA environment and has you know reconfigured bits of it, and now it's not working properly.
Is there a way to revalidate? If my dev's been in my QA environment, we don't have a tool issue. We have a process issue.
Yeah.
Right. That's the first thing. That's the first way I would answer that. Is like that's not a tool issue. That's a process issue. Now what we're going to try to do is use a tool to determine has that environment been invalidated in some sort, right?
You know, people who are using Puppet, and it's continuously validating and you know potentially auditing and if not fixing those kind of things, whether we can use it to do stuff like that.
Desired state configuration, the answer is yes, right? Because every time I tried to deploy to it, let's say, for example, a developer went on there and enabled or disabled anonymous authentication for whatever reason, and that was something that had to be true, the next deployment, DSC would go and check, is anonymous enabled? If not, it would re-enable it for us, right? So it wouldn't necessarily verify that, oh, has it been changed and I should alert someone? It will simply fix it for you before it deploys your code to that environment.
Donovan?
Go ahead.
Actually, you can set DSC that it will reapply the configuration ongoing. Like
I think
by default is every 4 or 5 minutes. So for the
it does solve the configuration drift. And in that sense, so if somebody goes a few minutes later, the mock file is reapplied and the change is reverted back to the desired state. So if you look at it, IAM is actually just using that mechanism. We just update the MOF. At the next update, we reapply the last one. And basically, if somebody comes in between, we'll just, you know, DSC will just reset to the right place.
Yeah, a little bit more technical answer to that one there is that DSC works in two modes, push or pull. To actually have the server go and pull it back, you have to first configure what we call a pull server. Once you configure a pull server, that is where you then store all of the resources that are going to define your environment. And then you configure each individual node to go pull that at whatever time you want and say, always make sure that you look the way that you're supposed to, right? So any change I make will be trounced by the next update, and that can be any time that you want. Now, currently, what RM is, what we're doing is we're pushing the configuration to you, right? I don't have a pull server configured here. Are we going to allow both of those to work in unison? Yeah. So I was thinking, because I said that the other day, I was thinking, one person says, well, I want to make sure the configuration always stays the same, even if, oh, did everyone, did someone see Internet Explorer pop up there? Okay, good. So what we're talking about is the ability to have both a pull and a push scenario. Pulling, where I'm pulling just the configuration, IIS.net, and then I'm pushing just the files that I want. So it's any combination of that that you want. So DSC can work in both ways. But the next time I push it, it would fix it anyway as well, right? Any other questions before we move on?
Yeah, to hook in a little bit on that question, it's API driven, the things you do with the DSC. So for instance, if an hotfix is not applied properly, how can you guarantee that your system is still the same? Do you also use this kind of methodologies for full stack deployments instead only releasing a piece of software and a piece of code?
The way that I would answer that is if there is a way for me to test that it has been installed correctly or not, then I could write a resource that goes and test, and if not, then set it appropriate, either by rolling it back or whatever action I want to take. So the flexibility in DSC is, you answer your own question on, is there a way for me to test and verify that, yes, that happened correctly? And if so, then I can write the resource that has that test method that goes and verifies that, yes, it's true. And if it's not true, then I would write my set that would take whatever action necessary to bring it to the state that I want it to.
For example, checking the binaries as well, instead of only...
If I can write a PowerShell to do it, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. There was one more hand went up. Okay, two more hands went up. We're about to go into Q&A here full on in a second. So Claude, by the way, Claude is actually the inventor and creator and owner of Release Management. So we have the best person in the world to answer questions if I get stumped. But the fact that that ran Internet Explorer means that what I'm about to show you is going to work. So that's good. What was the next question?
So if you had an application that had to be deployed multiple times in different configurations, how would you go about setting that up in Release Management and DSC?
Actually, exactly the way that I created the pipeline. Let me go back and clarify. So what I would do in a situation like that is I would define my release path to contain all the different environments that I needed. So consider a stage maps to an environment, right? So if I have 10 environments, you would actually see 10 boxes across the screen here. And at each stage, I would be able to go back in and configure whatever values I needed to. So transforming web.configs, transforming the properties file that I showed you, that happens at the, like, it's almost like it happens in between each of those items there, right? As we move it across, is kind of how I envision it in my head.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you.
There was another question, I believe, yeah, we were going to come back to here in the center.
This might be a bit simple question,
no,
but you mentioned about scheduling deployment to the test environment or QA environment, and it's still scheduled push way. So I was wondering, for instance, you're working in a dynamic environment where you have a Scrum team, both testers and developers there, and your tester is working on one story and you're about to deploy the second one, but the other one, we don't know exactly when the first test will be finished, so we would like to have ability to our tester to tell us when they want to actually get that deployed. Can we schedule, and we don't know exact schedule, so how can we do that?
Okay, perfect. So again, if we were to go back, just combine two answers, right? If we were to use the branching strategy that I mentioned earlier, feature one would come in, the QA team would start testing it, right? They don't know when they're going to be done, and they automatically get another email saying, okay, there's another build that's coming in. They have two options. Just ignore the notification until they're ready to say it's okay or not, right? That notification will sit there indefinitely waiting for you to come and say, I approve or I reject or reassign this particular item. So if I don't know, then just don't know. Just go finish what you're working on. And when you do know, go and either approve it or schedule it. And you can reschedule it. So let's say, for example, I scheduled it from a week from today, and that time is quickly coming and I'm still not done. I can go back, find that, and change the date and say, okay, I need another week, right? I need another week. So it's up to you. Either leave it in queue and then go back and get it when you know the definitive date, or just simply keep updating the date for when you want it deployed. Question in the back?
So my question is, it's more about organization and so if you're not using this right now, but you have a more of a manual process, what are the top key things you can start doing to transition to using these kind of tools?
Learn PowerShell. That's literally number one, is learn PowerShell. And even if you're not going to DSC, learn PowerShell, right? It's that important to us right now. It's on everything. It's on your Xbox. It's going to be everywhere. So if you don't know PowerShell, learn PowerShell. How I learned PowerShell, because I think that is step number one, is learn PowerShell, is I watched this amazing series of videos on YouTube. Oddly enough, they weren't in a playlist. So I have a channel on YouTube, and I created a playlist of someone else's videos so that you could go and watch them. I think it's like 22 videos on PowerShell that took me from knowing nothing about PowerShell to being able to write things like this, right? So if you go to donovanbrown.com, up in the top, there's a videos link. Click on that link, and it will take you to my YouTube channel, and then just search around for my playlist. You'll see the one for PowerShell, right? I forget the name of the company who did it. They did a fantastic job. That's step number one, right? The second thing I would do is start talking to your infrastructure team. Make sure that the environments in which you want to go to even support DSC, right? So, for example, you're going to need to at least be able to run WMF4, which is the Windows Management Framework 4.0. I believe that's supported on 2008 R2 and above. It's supported on Windows 7 and above. If you are installing a Windows Server 2012 R2 machine, it already has all the bits on it, right? That's why we call it agentless, is because if you're using some of the newer versions or Windows 8.1, you don't have to do anything to those machines. RM can immediately start deploying to those machines without you lifting a finger. So that's the second thing that I would do. Third thing I would do is just get familiar with RM, right? Understand the pipeline, understand what DevOps really means, what you want to get out of it, and what you want to do in each individual stage. Go ahead, Claude.
Maybe mention the manual intervention as a starting point behind the pipeline.
Sure. Some of the items that, actually, good point, because there's a couple items I didn't go over when we're building a release path. And for those leaving early, you're going to miss the Wintellect. There was a Wintellect at the end. 21 days of free Wintellect for those who stay. Let's put it that way. And here is a, let's look at a template. Over here, we have things like manual intervention and rollback. So should something bad happen on any stage above my rollback, it'll start rolling things back for me, right? This is really, really important because not all deployments go the way we want them to. Right, and getting that machine back into a known good state can be a challenge. But because we have things like manual interventions and we have rollbacks, the automatic rollbacks, we can actually detect that something went wrong, trigger a rollback, and start putting your system back the way it was before we ever touched it. Right? And a manual intervention will basically send an email to the person that you select, and then he'll have the instructions that what he has to do should something bad happen or we just want to have some manual interventions involved. Because everything that you do today might not be automated. Right, but we want to start working down that path. So where we can't automate, you can put in a manual intervention and someone will go get on that machine. But now we still have that audit trail that we wanted to before. Is that good? Okay, here's another question.
Let's say for instance, if it's SharePoint on-premise, is there anything, any nuances?
Yeah, it's called SharePoint. That's the nuance, right? If you've ever developed for SharePoint, it can be a challenge. But there are lots of, there's I forget the name of the tool for but you can almost do anything and everything. I think it's a SharePoint admin or something like that. Yeah, there's a command line tool. So basically we have a CLI, command line interface, that we can exploit using PowerShell to do whatever we want inside of SharePoint. So that, again, learn PowerShell. Sounds like a joke, but I'm being dead serious, right? If you learn PowerShell, you can literally make release management do anything you want it to do. And I mean anything. If I can write a PowerShell to do it, we can now add that action to our pipeline and get all the validation, all the chrome, and all the polish that release management adds to those PowerShells for you. So when it comes to things like SharePoint or SSIS, which I did in a previous demo, it's all about being able to determine how can I do this from PowerShell, and then if I can do that, I can then add it to my pipeline. So let's go back real quick and let's wrap up a little bit here. So let me make sure that this did actually work the way I wanted it to. So if I were to go back now to my website that's on my QA machine, what I should see on my QA machine is exactly what I saw before. This is a Linux machine that was updated by a Windows machine using release management. I just want to make sure that everyone leaves this room saying, wow, I can use TFS even if I'm not a .NET developer. Wow, I can use release management even if I'm not deploying to a Windows machine. It doesn't matter if it's Linux, it doesn't matter if it's on-prem or in the cloud, it doesn't matter if it's Java or .NET, Team Foundation Server and release management can take you from the idea to actually deploying your bits into production regardless of your cross-platform. Because cross-platform to me is two sides of the same coin. Where I did my development, was I on a Linux machine? Was I using Eclipse and Java or .NET? And then where am I going to deploy my code? Was I running a Linux machine, a Mac, or Unix, right? So there's two sides to the same coin. And what's nice is that with Release Management and Team Foundation Server, we have you covered on both sides. Comes up heads or tails, we got you covered, right? No matter where you do your development and no matter where you want to deploy it to, you can use our tools at Microsoft to get you there. So that whole stigma of we only do our stuff and it's the walls are falling down, right? We're trying to make sure that we play nice with everyone. So as I promised, I want to make sure that I give you guys your gift. So for those who stayed. So let's go ahead and get past this guy here. Just a quick recap. We looked at how we could release code to Windows and to Linux simultaneously using Team Foundation Server. We ran automated tests. Well, you guys saw it. I was too busy answering questions. But when Internet Explorer popped up, it was actually going through hitting that Linux website, verified that the text was what it was supposed to be, and then closed it back down to verify that our code actually deployed correctly. And then we automated leaving that stage. If all the tests passed, there's no reason for human intervention. Just go ahead and move on to the next stage for us as well. We actually got to see DSC. So I hope that guy who wrote that was in here, and I hope that I made up for what we did on Wednesday. And I hope that if he's not, he gets to see this on Channel 9. I showed you what a custom resource was, showed you the anatomy of one. It's simply just an interface. You just implement those three different methods in PowerShell, and then you can have your own interface, or your own resource added to the pipeline. And we obviously talked about pipelines at depth as well. So. This is what some of you guys have been waiting for. Please take out your cameras, take a picture, write this down. This will give you 21 days of unlimited access to Wintellect Now. There's a lot of great videos up there. You can learn any technology that you want. Release management happens to be one of those topics. By yours truly, I'm an author for Wintellect. This is why they gave me this code. So just go to Wintellect Now, enter in this code, you'll get 21 days of unlimited access, right? And have a blast. There's a lot of good stuff out there. Do me a favor, watch my video too. That helps me out a little bit. You probably know how, but please watch that video. We've already kind of done an impromptu Q&A, so we're kind of done there as well. Please feel free to follow me on Twitter or on anywhere else. These are just some of the resources that we have. And thanks again so much for sharing this with me. It was really great. Which one? Oh, yeah. You know I read the evals, so please read or so please go back in and do those. If you were in my first session and this session, please do them both. It means a lot to me because it allows me to come back and speak for you guys again in the future. What else is on here? Is that it? I think it has our little sticker thing here in a minute. I can't. Yeah, we need that little, I thought it was in here, but I don't see it.